spent the whole week last week talking about the birth of Heracles, which was very strange. But after he was born, things didn't get any more straightforward. I don't know, you know, even if somebody made up the myths and they weren't of some divine meaning, it still would be quite a creative feat. What happens is after Heracles is born, and Alcmene gets wind of his true parentage, she has a great deal of fear also. Not of Zeus, but of Hera, because Hera is very jealous and didn't even want the child to be born. And so she did something that is very common in Greek mythology especially. She took the child out to a plain outside of Athens and just left it there and exposed it. Now, this is a theme that comes up again and again. If you remember, Oedipus was exposed and other people were exposed. And I've never really understood it, or I don't have an understanding of an esoteric meaning of it. On one hand, it indicates like a denial of responsibility to have a child, especially a child of divine parentage, and not to bring it up shows an attitude of somebody that really is rather lackadaisical about parental responsibility or about caring at all. But then on the other hand, the philosophy that the Greeks had about it was altogether different. To them, it represented the ultimate of faith. They felt that if a child was exposed to the elements, that this was the most faithful thing that they could do, because it meant that they trusted destiny, that if the child was supposed to endure, and if it was supposed to go on, it would. And this way, it's a non-interventional kind of upbringing, but it's also an attitude of now. In a parent, that does, especially when the when it's just an infant, that doesn't sound really too cool. But if you think about it, I think it's the attitude that we, as becoming heroes, or we as becoming spiritually unfolded people, should have. It represents a vulnerability, because if we aren't completely open to everything, we're going to miss essential things. And if we aren't completely open, we're not going to be able to give. And if there's restraint, it'll both hurt us and lose an opportunity. So the whole nature of exposure, I think, is what is meant by exposure. That I don't think that we should become reclusive, and I don't think that we should hide ourselves from any kind of temptation or any kind of experience, though I don't think we should seek out things either, or even test ourselves. If I'm not mistaken, Gandhi used to sleep with women just to prove that he could be celibate in any kind of situation. But at any rate, Athena, who is the daughter of Zeus and partial to him, in fact, there always have been struggles between some of the primary feminine goddesses in Greek mythology. Athena, Hera, and Aphrodite often struggled with each other. But she comes up to Hera and says, why don't we just take a casual stroll down on Earth? And they just happen to wander on this plain outside of Thebes, and Athena says, "Wow, is that a wonderfully robust infant?" And she says the mother must have been crazy to abandon that infant. And so she draws Hera's attention to the child. And once the attention is drawn to it, she's suggested, and her suggestion is true. The infant is indeed very strong, very robust, very comely. And Athena persuades her to suckle the infant. And what happens is she puts Heracles to her breast, that he sucks so strongly and so intensely that she cries out with pain. And when she pulls him away, a spurt of milk goes out and it becomes the Milky Way. a little bit of hyperbole there, maybe. But the whole idea is that now that she has suckled him, it's the same thing as mixing blood. The notion that, you remember that the Native Americans had, it was pretty common all over the world, that if you mix blood, you become united. Not only mixing blood by being born with a common heredity, but mixing and sharing blood itself. Because very clearly, the mammary glands do nothing but change blood to milk with very, in very short order. There's not much, not a whole lot of change that takes place. And so this is sort of like on the same idea where the Bible says, "And the two shall be as one flesh." That when there, that it is possible to become intermingled etherically in such a way that you are almost like part of the other person, that their thoughts affect you and yours affect them, and something like that is what is taking place. Even the whole idea about the Milky Way is not really too strange. It's very common. There are similar myths of to this in all societies for the birth of the Milky Way. Even going all the way back to what was Hey Diddle Diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon. Remember that? That was supposed to be the origin of the Milky Way. And I think it has something to do with Zeus and Hera being associated with divinities of our sun, and the sun itself is a star, and that by raising something else or giving the creative energy or in the creation of something else, you raise yourself as well. But at any rate, Hera goes trooping back to Olympus, and Athena takes the little baby and takes her back to Alcmene and says, "Guard and rear him well." And she promises to do that. And to this day, at the city, outside of the city of Thebes, it's still called the Plain of Heracles. Again, there are variations, not important ones, at least as far as I can see. Some say that Zeus took the child up to Olympus while Hera was asleep and put the child to her breast. But at any rate, now he has two divine parents. When Hera became a wet nurse to him, then both Zeus and Hera are parent to him, and having two divine immortal parents, he himself is ready to become an immortal. And after this happens, he is no longer known as Alcaeus, he is known as Heracles. But Heracles didn't, but Hera didn't give up easily yet. She had other notions. When the twins, Iphicles and Heracles, were 8 years old, their mother, Alcmene, used to put them to sleep every night inside the shield of their father, which in itself is quite an interesting thing, because those big circular shields all had spirals on them. I don't know if you're familiar with pyramids and Hieronymus machines and things like that, but Patrick Flanagan, the man that did all of that crazy work with the pyramids demonstrating their energy potential and all, he made various types of devices that produced an energy. And one of them was a metal plate that was alternately conducting and non-conducting that formed a spiral like that. Quite a few of the Greek shields were in spiral fashion. Very often they were, triskions. So that you had spirals like this. And let's see, another one here. And this, you know, these are far-fetched notions, but they claim that their shields gave them strength. And they gave them names and everything else. And there are myths and stories and claims that the South American priests were capable of levitating themselves on circular shields that were made out of gold, that they used the gold to do the transducing of energy. But at any rate, she set them in, every night she laid the twins in this big shield, and she covered them up with a fleece, which is another itself energy-producing or energy-carrying device. And that's the way they slept. What happened was, at midnight, she sent two very large serpents that had azure scales. And she set them into the nursery, and they made their way into the shield. And Iphicles first awoke and saw the large serpents and started crying and making up a whole big scene out of the business. And that woke Alcmene, and she woke Amphitryon, and he comes with his sword. And when he gets to the nursery, here is Heracles strangling both serpents to death in his bare hands, and they're looking at his ears while he does that. This is not a normal childhood. In fact, there are vases, urns that still have these kinds of pictures on them that go back to Greek times. Now, this looks just like another wild tale, and it looks like a far-fetched story. But the time of Heracles was the time when the equinox was precessing through Taurus. And the equinoctial point through the constellation of Taurus is sort of like the ascendant of the world. And that is the outer attitudes and the outer, you might say, fad of the millennium or dual millennium that is going on. In the same way that the personality is indicated by the ascendant, the individuality is indicated by the seventh house cusp. And therefore, the autumnal equinoctial point indicates the more esoteric side of things or the inner side of things. And so the opposite side that had to do with the priests had to do with Scorpio. I don't know of there in any society in the world, I don't know of a scorpion priesthood, but there were plenty of eagle priesthoods, and most notably in the Mideast, the priesthoods were serpent priesthoods. In fact, all over in the East, there was the Nagas in India, and Urias in Egypt, and in the Mid East, it was the Ophites. And what the serpents seem to represent is they seem to represent a priesthood. And the priesthood, it was dressed in blue. Blue at that time was the sacred color for the priests. The kings had purple tufts in their hair, supposedly by heredity. We'll go along with the mythical tradition. In fact, that was one of the ways that you could tell a true king is by the patch of hair on the top of his head. But I don't know that the blue was a sacred color for any reason except that the highly spiritual individuals at one stage of their development have a very shining blue kind of aura. And it's a very aspirational and uplifting aura. But at any rate, these represent the priesthood of the time. And Heracles, after these serpents had licked his ears clean, was capable of understanding the language of the animals. Most notably, he was associated with the vulture. If you look in the heavens, I should have brought my picture of the heavens. Heracles is in the area of the pictorial zodiac, in the pictures of the constellations that could be called stymphalos. We're going to see later on that some of the things that he did, some of the labors that he did, one of them was the killing of the stymphalian birds. And in that part of the heavens where Heracles is, are where all of the stymphalian birds are. To the south, there is the eagle that is part of Scorpio, and then there is Aquila the eagle, and there is the diving eagle, which is Lyra, and there is the great swan. And so all of the birds are in that part of the heaven where Heracles is standing with his foot on the head of the dragon. But at any rate, he was the birds that he could hear most were the vultures. And Heracles identified himself with the vultures because they were the most harmless of all of the animals because they never killed a single thing and they never took the life of anything. And so Heracles modeled his life after the vultures in that he never was the aggressor in any situation, but he always returned what the people were feeling toward himself, and he took this as an ideal. As far as modern heroes are concerned, I'm not even sure that retributive justice or retributive action is right. And we're going to see in a little minute that Heracles was none too soft and sweet and gentle of a person, even though he claimed to never have been the aggressor. Some say that it was Amphitryon that put the serpents in his own shield when the kids went to sleep because he was uncertain which was his own son. Remember the ambiguous parentage that we looked into last week. He was uncertain which was his own son and which one was the son of Zeus, and he wanted to know which was which so he could be certain to respect the right one. Yes, bright blue. I don't know if there really is a azure serpent or a bright blue serpent anywhere on the earth. I have no idea. There are quite a few things like coral snakes that are bright colored, but I don't know of any blue ones. If you find out, I'd appreciate it. But at the third crow of dawn. Alcmene is greatly upset by all of this. Third crow of dawn having to do with the completion of the manifestation of light, the one, the two, the three. And she goes, she calls Tiresias to come to her because she has to find out what this means, that her son is strangling serpents to death in the middle of the night and such like that. He foretells her of the glories of Heracles, that he's going to be a great and powerful hero and leader of humans, and eventually he's going to be divine. And he tells her to do some strange things. He tells her to take gorse and thorn bush and brambles and to put them on the hearthstones and to take the serpents' carcasses and put them on that and at midnight to burn them up. And then she is supposed to take the ashes to the perch where the Sphinx used to bother the people of Thebes before Oedipus drove it away by solving its riddle. And she is commanded not to look back after she scatters the ashes there and leaves them to the four winds. And she's supposed to take the, to purify the temple, she's supposed to wash it and sprinkle it with spring water that has been salt been put in it, and to put sulfur around the temple, and that will purify it. Now, this is all very, very curious. All of the bramble berries and the thorns are very martial. And I think what is here is that the notion it is like fighting fire with fire, that the serpents have always had this dual meaning. On one hand, they have been the symbol of sin and evil with the cold reptilian attitudes and those glaring eyes and such with no mercy in them. But on the other hand, the serpents have always been the symbol of wisdom. But at any rate, they are returned to the elements by fire. And I tend to think there's something alchemical here because the salt, sulfur, and the aqua vitae or the mincerum, let's just say the is that how it's spelled? Is that how it's spelled in Latin? The only thing that's missing here is the mercury. And this has to do with the famous alchemical formula of the different segments of the spine being associated with different elements, and that to raise the spinal fire, the serpentine spinal fire, is a matter of, there's a lesson in each of these three stages before it can be brought up, before the fire can be brought up and mixed with the water in the cranium to produce the kind of clairvoyance that is necessary to become a divine seer. I do know that the formula that Tiresias as far as serpents are concerned, the formula, the sulfur part of it, works to this day yet. That if you have a place that is infested with snakes, like if you have a lot of trouble with rattlesnakes or something like that coming around the house too much, or if they become unpleasant nuisances, all you have to do is take little nuggets of sulfur, that blue sulfur, the 98% pure, and just put it around, and then no more snakes. It's an interesting thing. I learned that from Al Dong, who is, I don't know where he gets these notions, but they they indeed work. He helped a friend of mine get rid of snakes out of his little farmette by using sulfur. But at any rate, Heracles is, or the temple is purified, and Heracles begins to grow up. And he has a pretty remarkable upbringing. He has a great education. His father teaches him chariotry. And Castor takes embodiment and teaches him weapons and cavalry and tactics and strategy. And one of Mercury's sons, Hermes' sons, it's not clear which one, taught him boxing. And another one taught him the art of archery. And he even surpasses the greatest archer of his time, even as a boy. And the greatest archer of his time was capable of shooting through a ring on the top of a helmet that was fashioned like a serpent. And this is another thing that was involved in the mystery cults. It goes all the way back. It's still celebrated here out at, what's the little Swiss town, New Glarus, that one of the things was that you were supposed to take your son and with the serpent wrapped around it with your bow, kill the serpent without killing your son. And then it evolved into shooting a coin standing on edge or shooting an apple off of your progeny. And then it came to be that on the top of the crest of a helmet, they would have a serpent emblem. And then it evolved so that the hero had to shoot an arrow through the serpent ring on the top of the helmet. And eventually it evolved so far that you had to shoot through a whole series of rings. Yeah, this is the way culture develops. If you remember, a number of people did this. Odysseus had this same trial, and Rama had this same trial. Only Rama had a steel bow, which I think had something to do with the Atlantean type of initiation. In fact, I even think he shattered the steel bow, if I remember right. You've ever read Ramayana? Okay. So, but at any rate, the whole notion, the apple or the serpent in a circle, was a emblem of eternity in time. And that the shooting of an arrow through the center of it. See, the shooting of the arrow was associated with having a perfect concentrated focus, which is absolutely necessary to get at the heart of anything. And this was developed through the process of learning various different physical skills. And most notably, in quite a few cultures, it was through the learning of archery. There are many stories about it, like Krishna as a boy is being taught, along with a number of other boys, to shoot a bird out of the top of a tree where the wind is blowing the tree and things like that. And all the boys are trying to do this and they all miss. And Krishna succeeds. And the teacher asks each of them what they saw at the moment they let the arrow go, and only Krishna says, the eye of the bird. Well, meaning to say that you keep your eye on the prize, as the modern lingo has it. And this is the ability to center. This ability to center within time is what introduces one to eternity through the moment. The serpent that is swallowing its own tail is an endless cycle of time, an eternal cycle of time. And so the whole process then is a centering process, and a very important one at that. No need to go on to it much more than that. Eumolpus taught him the lyre, and Linus taught him literature, and somebody else, the name is not given, taught him astronomy and philosophy. So in short, he was taught all of the physical skills, all of the arts, and all of the sciences. But in almost all cases, his tutors were divine, which means to say that he was God-taught. That in terms of the true hero, the initiate or the becoming initiate, all of the education that is really worthwhile is to be God-taught. Not necessarily by divinities from outside, but by divinity within, even though it may take the voice of different divinities in its inward presentation. And that is a, that's a general thing. I think that the artist who listens to the muse and the muse only is one that develops a true creativity and unfolds in a way that somebody who only takes lessons or learns by schooling and not by the teaching within is not going to get very far. But at any rate, Heracles was apparently rather stubborn, because at one time his lyre teacher was missing. And so Linus, who was a very accomplished, some people claim one of the greatest of all musicians of all time, decides to teach him lyre. But Heracles doesn't like the way that Linus is teaching him. It's different than what he's been taught before. So he bops him over the head with the lyre and kills him. Now, this seems to me a little bit of a contradiction about the fact that he was never the aggressor. But be that as it may, he was put on trial for murder. And he apparently knew the law pretty well, because there are three in the underworld of the Greeks. There are three people that are the judges. One is Minos, one is Rhadamanthes, I don't know how to pronounce it. I don't forget who the third one is. But he was famous for his judgment while he was alive, before he became a judge in the underworld. And Heracles quotes one of his judgments, saying that a person is justified to overcome somebody that is forcibly trying to be aggressive with him. And Heracles said he was being aggressive to my psyche by teaching me something in a way that I wasn't taught to be taught. And he got out of the whole situation. But it caused great alarm to his father, in that his father just didn't, the kid, he couldn't handle him anymore. So what he did is he made a cowboy out of him. He sent him, farmed him out to a ranch, and he worked on a ranch for the rest of his boyhood. Remember, this is the Taurian type. The Taurian time, in terms of precession, the equinox, and I think this has something to do, all of these things have probably inner meanings, and many of them I don't even miss or don't even get at or miss completely that they're there. But I think this has something to do with the democratization of him, that he wasn't to be reared only as a prince, but with priests and the people around the court, but he was actually to be a cowboy, meaning to be out with the masses and with the people. But at any rate, he grew to be, at 18 years old, he was the strongest and the fiercest and the fastest of all of the boys, and he had very flashing eyes, and he had an unerring aim. Whether he was using a spear or a bow, though his favorite instrument was a club, which I think has something to do with the power of will. He was chosen at age 18 to be the laurel bearer for the festival of Apollo, and he himself started the Olympian Games. If you'll remember, his birthday was celebrated on the fourth day of every month. But let's come back to that. He is said, and this is really interesting what different people have done, he's said to have been 4 Greek cubits. Oh, that's what I forgot to do. I was going to figure it out on a calculator. 4 Greek cubits tall. But Pythagoras figured out that he was taller than that. Because the reason why is, they had standards in those days. In fact, the smallest jug that was recognized was called a minim, and the largest jug that was recognized was called a maxim, and that's where our maxima and minima come from. And the size of a stadium for games competition was 600 stadia long. But 600 stadia were 600 paces, or is it 200 stadia? I got it in the notes here somewhere. No, I guess I don't. I don't know whether it's 200 or 600 stadia. Anybody know that, remember that? But an Olympic stadium is, even though it's 600 or 200 Olympic stadia are longer than a regular 600 or 200 of regular stadia. So from this, Pythagoras figured out that if Heracles was proportioned like everybody else and took steps in proportion to the size of his body, that he would not be 4 Greek meters tall, but he would be, cubits. But that he would be 4 Greek cubits and 1 foot, which would make him roughly around 6'6", which is a pretty big man for those times. I don't know if any of this is true, but it's a fascinating thing that, people like that would get interested in it. At any rate, he's not only a big man, but he had a big appetite. Only he almost never ate lunch, but instead he ate big suppers. And his favorite foods were barley cakes, which everybody in that part of Greece really liked, and roasted meat, which doesn't make him very beloved to me in many ways. And he would rather sleep outdoors than indoors. So he was like a really rugged, rough and ready person. He was a profound augurer, that he knew the lay of things and knew what was coming. And he especially augured in the same way that Tiresias did, by hearing birds, but most especially by hearing vultures. Tiresias, when he was struck blind, was given the power of hearing the language of the birds, which means hearing or being able to read thoughts and being able to read out of the region of concrete thought. But at 18 years old, he started looking for adventure, and so when the games of Apollo were over, there in the neighborhood were Mount Kithaeron and Mount Helicon. And there was a lion in those mountains, and that lion was terrorizing his father's cattle. And so he decided to hunt for the lion. And Kithaeron, if you remember, is where Oedipus was exposed. And at any rate, as he's hunting the lion, he comes over to the neighborhood of King Thespius, who is one of the neighborhood kings. And the Thespians were very happy people, and they liked to celebrate a lot. And they celebrated at midsummer. And they celebrated by dancing and acting out dramas, which means that there were mysteries involved. To this day, yet, the acting out of a mystery drama, or anybody who is an actor, is still called a thespian. And this is where it comes from. And they acted out their dramas, and there were fertility rites involved, because it was considered, and I think rightly so, a divine duty for the people who were healthy and noble and educated and had all of these qualities to be gentle people, for them to bear fruit. And so a lot of the royalty was at Midsummer Festival. A lot of royalty was conceived because they went by the formula that for somebody who was to be a ruler of the earth and earthly things, they were conceived at midsummer and born at vernal equinox, born with the sun when the sun comes to bring things up. But at any rate, Heracles is in these parts, and he gets invited to the festival, and a most unusual thing happens. Thespius had 50 daughters. this goes right back again to remember Aegyptus and Danny, the great, 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 great grandfather. Probably, maybe there should be one more great in there, I think, of Heracles. That there were 50 sons that married 50 daughters, and the daughters all killed the sons. Here we're back at that again. Heracles, on 50 subsequent nights, slept with all 50 daughters. However, the last one, the youngest one, this is just the opposite of the story by Danny, the youngest one remained virgin, and he trusted her purity and innocence. As a consequence of this, Heracles sired 51 children, so there must have been a couple of sets of twins in there. And at any rate, if we remember, Heracles' birthday was celebrated on the 4th of every month. And we're saying that we've been looking at Heracles, or we began to look at Heracles last time, as the hero's hero, because there are at least 4 or 5 distinct schools of Heracles' mysteries that spread all the way into England, like the Idaean, the school of Mount Ida, where it was Heracles of the dactyls, of the birches, that they would grab the joints of their hands while they chanted their poetry. Poetry actually came out of spiritual chanting, and it was part of a spiritual exercise. It was sort of like, I think the way it goes is the stage that goes between mantras to chanting poetry to what our modern poetry is, that the bringing of the spiritual light down to earth. But at any rate, being the hero's hero, he represents the sun. And therefore, this is very much like the story of Jacob having 4 wives. Two wives and their 2 handmaidens, and from them all of the signs of the zodiac are born. But in Heracles' case, it's different. Every 4th year, approximately, the sun and moon are in the same position relative to each other at the same time. And so this was very sacred to the people, and this is one of the things that influenced Julius Caesar to make a bad decision about his calendar. He had every 4th year be a leap year because it was considered the Olympiad, rather than having occasionally one that didn't have a leap year day. Every 400 years, I believe it is, or is it every 40 years that you don't, that you, is 400? Okay. Yeah, but if it's divisible again by 4,000, then you throw it in again. Yeah, I think that's how it goes. I wrote a program on it one time for calendration. But the way it goes is that there are 13 lunations a year, and 4 years worth of lunations makes 52 lunations, and the cycle of the 50, which is rounded off, the cycle of the 50 is related to the Olympiad, and it is related to the sun coming back to into its power and into its rhythm again with the moon. The fact that he had 51 children, and there are obviously a couple sets of twins in there, the fact that there were 51 children in one barren or one virgin, remember that was the same thing, that this is one is always considered the transition to the next cycle. There's always a carryover that things remain unbroken. It's a notion that I haven't got completely worked out in my consciousness yet, so I can't go any further with the notion. So at any rate, this indicates then that that the whole myth is a lunar myth, a solar myth, and it has to do with the pacing of the sun relative to the moon and the bringing things forth through the moon. When this is all over, what Heracles does is he goes out and he cuts from a wild olive tree, he goes and cuts a club and gets the lion and beats it to death with the club. Now, this is very important. This is important because where the people were initiated, like for example in Midsummer Night's Dream, if you look at the directions for the play to be put on, it takes place in an open space in the woods outside of Athens, which is where the Eleusinian Mysteries were celebrated. In this circle, the circle of trees, there were 13 trees. And each of those trees was of a different species. And each of them related to the character and quality of the lunation. That they had a whole science of this, that different kinds of things could be taught and be brought about in the spiritual consciousness of one under different new moons. And so the first one in the cycle was the wild olive tree. And so that when he was all done with the 50 daughters, he starts his activity by clobbering the lion. This is not the main lion that he clobbers, but there's a lot of redundancy in these stories. But he clobbers the lion with a wild olive tree club. That was his favorite device all the way through. So I would assume then that it would be very similar to the regular zodiac, and that there would be something about the elemental initiatory, let's get it off with a real, started off with a real jolt, and that the first new moon in the cycle with the wild olive would be associated astrologically like that. Okay, now we have to go into a little sub-drama. We're leading up to the big works of his life, but there are quite a few things that happen along the way. And it happened that he was living in Thebes, because remember Amphitryon was banished for killing his father-in-law in that curious way, the way it happened that we talked last time. And he was living in Thebes. But Thebes at this time was in a very great state of shame. What happens is they got into a fight with the Minyans. And I don't know what the war was over, but the Minyans defeated them soundly. And the Minyans not only defeated them, but they disarmed them. They took away all of the arms of the people, and they forced them to pay tribute for 20 years. And each year, the Thebans were supposed to bring 200 cattle to the Minyans. So what happens when Heracles is coming down out of Mount Helicon after having dispatched the lion? He falls in with the heralds that are coming from the Minyans to Thebes to collect the tribute, and he makes friends with him and starts talking, and he finds out what is their business, and they tell they're the tribute collectors, and he said that taking tribute was terribly unjust. And he got so angry that what he did is he took all of the heralds and he cut off all their noses and cut off all their ears and cut off all their hands and tied them on cords and hung the cords around their neck and sent them back home. I don't understand the meaning of that. Clearly it has something to do with the senses, and I don't know what it does. I just can't speculate on things that are not ripe for me and things that I don't understand yet. If I did this again on another year, by then I probably would have come further. But you know, you got to get out what you can get out now before you can learn something new. But at any rate, he realizes that things are not going to be pleasant, and so he goes back to Thebes and tells Creon about what he did, and there's great horror because clearly the Minyans are going to come and have their vengeance. And so what Heracles does, he doesn't want to give up that easily. He doesn't want to pay a higher tribute. It's a shame to have to submit to anyone. So he goes around to all of the temples, and in the temples, they have embedded spears and shields and things like that that honor the ancestors. And he rips them out of their mountings on the wall, and he teaches the Thebans the art of war. And when the Minyans come, he, since he knows the mountains by now, having tracked the lion all through the mountains, he knows where there's a pass that they have to come through, and he ambushes them and defeats most of the Minyans by himself alone. And he takes the war to their city, and what he does is they're a wealthy nation because they have drained a swamp area and it's very rich soil. So what he does is he dams it back up again and floods the swamp and goes and batters down their gates and destroys their royalty but does not demand tribute from them. And then he unblocks the river again, and because he doesn't want to, he wants to be a good guy. what to say it. But at any rate, he frees both his people and the Minyans, and when he gets back to Thebes, he dedicates an altar to Zeus, which, if I'm not mistaken, is a very famous altar. I don't know if we'll have time to go into it somewhere along the line. And he makes a stone lion, and he gives that in honor of Artemis, and he makes two images of Athena and gives them to the people of Thebes. The people of Thebes hold their breath because they figure that if, Heracles might have divine retribution for this. And after a reasonable amount of time, the gods have brought no wrath down on the head of Heracles. And so they raise their own statue, and they call it the statue of Heracles, the nose docker. Now you would expect that even if we take these, especially if we take these stories in the most obvious and profane sense and aren't looking for anything mythical, anything with mysterious meanings behind all of this, Heracles has led a rather wild life. First of all, he commits the first sin, the sin of Adam, at least 49 times. And he's not married to any of the daughters. And he commits the sin of Cain, the second sin, quite a number of times in defeating the Midianites. So in short, he has been sexually and violently excessive. And this is not dear to the gods. And so what they do is he carries on in his ways for a while. It's not, you know, he's given Creon, the king gives him his eldest daughter, and he has, indeterminate how many sons he has, but he has at least six sons. And he continues his violent ways. There's another troublesome neighboring king that lives along a river, and he lives along a river where the sound of the river sounds like colts neighing. And what he does is troublemaking king, he captures him, and he ties one leg to one colt and another leg to another colt and has him ripped in half. And he does all sorts of things like this. But then Hera gets angry with him because he's starting to bear her name now, and she can't be having a son that goes to all of these excesses, and she drives him mad. And so he goes crazy. And almost all heroes at some time, but especially the martial heroes, because Heracles clearly has a lot of martial qualities in him, all of the martial heroes go mad. Like if we look in the stories of the King Arthur, the knight who probably killed more people than other people and who was who cuckolded his own king, Lancelot, also went mad. In the it's like saying that the switching, the period that we are in the Earth period, the first half of it is considered the Mars half. The second half is considered the Mercury half. The sins of the first half are sins of commission. And the retribution of the sins of commission are martial-like diseases. Diseases that have great fevers about them, and diseases that produce redness, rashes, things like probably the most famous being leprosy, but scarlet fever and rubella and measles and all of those infectious types of diseases with roaring temperatures belong to the first half. In the second half of the Earth period, the second half of the time in which we are human beings, in the Mercury half, we are more likely, with our minds, we're more likely to judge the outcome of our deeds, and we're more likely to the sins of omission. And with the sins of omission, we don't do the things that should be done. But there is a carryover of the sinning of one half into the sinning of the other half, so that the sins of the second half of the Earth period are madness. That the further on that we go, especially if we continue with our extreme materialism, is going to be greater and greater insanity. Because to some extent, all human beings are insane. Because one is insane when the divine spirit can't work all the way through its vehicles and come to its senses and control what it does in the world and what it draws out of the world as sensory experiences to feed the gods, that is, self and the whole of the divinities. And so the madness of Heracles clearly the initiation that is in the first half of the Earth period is an involutionary initiation. The initiations of the Atlanteans, they were taught things about the physical world, things that we almost take for granted that we know. But now, in the second half, when we are indeed evolving out of matter and learning to lead, you didn't have to teach the Atlanteans how to lead the body because they had consciousness in the inner worlds all the time. What you had to do is get them to stay in the body or to work through the body. And so the trial then, before one can leave the body, one has to be completely sane in the body, and that means one has to recognize one's insanity. Before you can follow through, you have to have come into the body and carry all the way through with your waking consciousness. And so it is a general trial of initiation that there is some degree of madness, and almost anybody who looks on our lives that has a worldly life would think that we're all mad for doing what we do and for looking into what we look into. So Heracles' case is no different. When he goes mad, he slays both of his nephews, both of Iphicles' sons. The younger daughter of Creon was married to Iphicles. The older daughter was married to Heracles, and so he slays both of his nephews, and then when he comes home, in his madness, he mistakes his own children for enemies, and he slays all six of his own children. In short, he has slain eight. And eight is sort of the number that is materialism carried too far, or carried to exclusion, to excess. Like, for example, there are several ways you can look at it. One way is that one, when it divides itself, becomes two. And in order for any creation to take place, there has to be an internal division between the known and the unknown, between the will and the imagination. When the two, which is, this is carried one, two, this is the third level, which is the divine perfection, when two is doubled, it becomes four. When four is doubled, it becomes eight. And four, if we take the notion of the Pythagorean triangle, it starts out with one point, and then the one divides itself within itself to come to know itself, and out of that are born the three, and from the three, they fall into the reflection of the four physical vehicles. So this is the unity. This is the great duality. This is the threefold spirit, and this is the fourfold body. And this, the four then, is the number of completion, or this is again looking at, this is a numerical way of looking at that casket. Remember when we talked about the casket that Osiris was in, or the casket that Perseus was in? This is a numerological or a spiritual arithmetic way of looking at the same thing. So if four then is the number, this is the Pythagorean decad. If four then, if the doubling process or the multiplying process of one, two, four, eight is carried, you know, this is carrying it, this is to the zero power, this is to the one power, this is to the second power, this is to the third power, so that if it's carried to the ultimate in the spirit and in the matter, it comes to the number eight. And therefore, the number eight represents something that has gone beyond the spirit, and it is beyond the intelligence of the spirit, and it is where things run off. Boy, this is a tough concept. I should have pondered this longer last night before I put it down on paper. It wasn't last night, it was the night before. it represents things that are carried to completion in matter, but things that are out of touch from the spirit. The octave is something being reborn on another level. And when that level happens to be out of complete control of the spirit, that's when things can go off on a tangent, when the consciousness can get into a hyper state. It's sort of the state that we have now. We can be so sensualistic and we can be so focused in our mind and stay in the fourfold body alone and deny the spirit so that the fourfold body can completely pull away from the spirit. This is why the eighth sphere was always considered the sphere of danger and the sphere of destruction. It's so associated in the solar system with the Saturn and Uranus, depending on how you break up the solar system. That's what we were talking about last night, the gateway to chaos and the dissolution and taking things out of matter. But, you know, like you can get into states that are so materialistic that there is nothing redeeming to them. You know, like there are people who get into, hyper-orgasms. And they live in a world of orgasm where it's become a thing to itself. And it has nothing to do with procreation. It has nothing to do with creation. And in a way, it doesn't even have to do with sex. It's gotten, you know, it's run off by itself. And that's what the number eight represents. The slaying of the eight children has to do... Each of the children was honored in a different way after they were slain, and they have to do with the non-fulfillments of the different planetary spheres, with the non-fulfillments within the internal solar cosmos in ourselves. But at any rate, he destroyed his own potential for creativity. He destroyed his own children very much as Saturn destroyed his own children. And this has something to do then with the need for redemption. And what happens is when he comes to his senses again and when he awakens, he is filled with a tremendous amount of grief and remorse, and he locks himself in a dark chamber and stays there all alone for a long, long, long time, which is, again, another theme that we come back to, that this is sort of like the tower that Perseus and Danny were in that was completely dark except for one little hole at the top. And it has to do with the state of isolation, meaning to say when we gradually we differentiate in the whole of involution. Gradually, we become more and more sophisticated in our forms, but we differentiate and we get further and further away from waking spiritual consciousness until we come to the point where we're at now, where we are in the dark. And then we have to take a leap of faith in order to find the light again so that we can progress out of this. And remorse is usually the feeling that starts that, because remorse is what starts us to unwind and to have regret about what we've done. This isn't just a mental connection between cause and consequence. When you look back at your own deeds and you have all of this remorse, it drives you. And when you look back at your own deeds and you draw the essence out of them, you develop your own internal light, meaning to say that you can be all alone and realize that you're all alone in isolation or in quarantine or in exile. You can be all alone, and in that loneliness you can turn inward and you can seek and find the light in yourself, because it is now built into you as a consequence of the remorse. And this is what marks the beginning of the path of apotheosis, which is what initiation is all about, which is what the 12 labors are all about. It is the redemption of that which was lost. And that always begins with remorse. I don't think that there has ever been anyone that has followed the path of initiation that hasn't been started on the whole path by realizing the egregious sins that they have done, and that hasn't been lonely and isolated, and in that loneliness began to think, and in that thinking began to analyze what they had done, why they really were alone. It's very important for a person to be alone and isolated and understand that that you may have done something, that you are alone. And so that's basically the place at the beginning of it all, like the attitude that Dante has when he goes into the underworld, is an attitude of despair. And with that despair, he is what brings him to go into the underworld. So he goes back to his old friend, King Thespius, because only a king can do the purification, and the king purifies him and says, you've recognized your state, you're in deep doo-doo, you better go and check with the oracle at Delphi. And when he gets to the oracle at Delphi, they had tripods. They were actually mediums that at Delphi, they had a beautiful, beautiful, lovely circular temple, round temple, and it was over a crevice that was in the earth. And they had a tripod, something like this, and suspended from that tripod was a basket, and in that basket the pythoness would sit, and when the vapors would come out of the earth, she would prophesy. There was something about the gases that did something that put her into that kind of state. Some people feel that to this day yet. I don't know whether it's due to the fluoride gases or what, but that the claim is that every time there's an earthquake, another clairvoyant is born. Obviously, the clairvoyance has to be developed by developing yourself, but the claim is that some of the physical stuff that you need to change or alter your body so that you're more amenable to clairvoyance is found deep in the earth, and that is when it's released from the earth and you get even the smallest whiff of it, if you're ready, that's what changes your body to be there for that experience. But at any rate, he went to the pythoness, and she told him that he was going to have a glorious career and that he was going to become divine, but that he first had to go to Eurystheus and live with him and do and serve Eurystheus and do whatever he said to do. And whatever when Eurystheus said that his labors were done, then he would be completely apotheosized and would be divine and would live in Olympus with his father. Now this didn't sit too well with Heracles, because the Greeks didn't like the idea of being anybody's servant. Even being the servant of the gods was not a really happy thing for them, and he grieved over this more, which is really important, because this is a different kind of grieving. I think that the most important, at least for myself, the most important thing that seems to go along with spiritual growth is losing the sense of self-importance. This pride and vanity, like I'm so important, and especially if we're self-consciously on the path, we think then that, well, that we're living the path that is the path of initiation, that makes us important people. And that self-importance is just the very attitude that keeps us from really growing spiritually. And before Heracles could really set off on the path, he had to confront and deal with that in himself and finally realize that he was that this was what he had to do. What else can we do but serve? But at any rate, he is put on a probation, as anyone on the spiritual path must be, and he's given presents to go along with this. There's one story of Heracles about when he was a youth. I didn't find it going through my books this time, but the story was that when he was a youth, two young maidens appeared to him. And the first one gave him visions and showed him that he could have pleasure, he could have ease, he could have wealth, he could have fame, he could have comfort if he became her votary. And her name was Pleasure. And the other one said, I can't give you anything, but you're probably, if you become my votary, you will have suffering and sorrow and pain and everything else that is unpleasant like that, but you will have love. And my name is Service. And according to that myth of Heracles, he took the path of service, and even though the mainstream story of Heracles has him going mad and doing all of these other things, but he sets out on his path of probation. And Hermes gives him a sword, very clear meaning. Apollo gives him a bow and arrow. Athena gives him a breastplate. Hephaestus gives him an adamant helmet. Poseidon gives him a team of horses. And Zeus gives him a shield. We're not going to do a lot of ostensive symbol picking. We'll just pass it on and say that he was now ready to go and do his labors and fulfill his destiny. And his one, or at least one of his living nephews, Iolaus, goes with him as shield bearer and charioteer, and he sets off to live with Eurystheus and do whatever he commands him to do as deeds of service. And the next couple of times, probably, we're going to be dealing with the 12 labors of Heracles, and then we'll deal with the latter life and death of Heracles. Hopefully we'll get this done in 3 talks.
3 more talks,
yeah. Heracles, yeah.